Let's take just a couple of minutes and talk about Solomon. Who is this guy? Tell me, who is Solomon? Give me something on him. He is the third king in the United Kingdom. Saul, David, Solomon. What else? He is David's son. This is the beginning of that dynasty of Judah. Saul was of Benjamite, and that dynasty did not last. And now we have the second in line there after David. Okay, what else? Unprecedented wisdom and riches. God gave him whatever he wished, and that's what he chose, and it paid great dividends for him. He did something amazing that David wanted to do. He built the temple. David prepared all the materials for him, and he built the temple. What kind of a guy is Solomon?
He started out very religious, but he let women get to him, and he turned out bad.
Started out really well, and maybe, hopefully, at the very, very end, pulled it back together. But even with all of his wisdom, he made some real mistakes in marrying foreign women and actually got pulled to their gods. And we read about that in the end of both of the accounts that you get in the Kings and in the Chronicles. He did do some writing. What are some of the letters that we have recorded and preserved for us that Solomon himself wrote? Proverbs, chapters 1 through 29, almost all Proverbs. Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon. Those are ones that we can for sure attribute to him. And you'll note there are also a couple of Psalms that you see on the booklet there that he wrote as well. Probably many, many Psalms, but two that we have identified. Okay, one of the books that we're studying of his this morning is the book of Ecclesiastes. And I read a little bit there from chapter 1. The way we have it laid out in your material is that the book of Ecclesiastes is answering a question. The question is in chapter 1, verse 3. What advantage does man have in all the work which he does under the sun? Everything that he does, from raising a family to choosing an occupation, gathering up goods, saving things, having fun, what is it all really about under the sun? And what is the answer?
God and keep his commandments, for this okay. is the whole of man.
The ultimate answer is fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. That's at the end of the book of Ecclesiastes. But how you have to read this book to kind of get it is, in verse 3, he's saying just under the sun. If you take God out of the picture, and it's not about faith, and it's not about eternity, and it's not about Jesus, and you just look at all of the things you do here without God. So that's what he means by under the sun. What is the advantage in all that you do?
It's a cycle.
Nothing. It's a cycle that has no forward progress. He says it five times in verse 1. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity, says the preacher. That means empty, futile, without substance, circular, but without forward progression. It just doesn't amount to anything. He takes the whole book, all 12 chapters, and he just keeps telling you how unfair life is. You know, the good guy dies and the bad guy lives, and oppression is not squashed out immediately. Sometimes the evil people take over, and you live a while and you die. And chapter 3, there's just a time for everything. Chapter 3, 1 through 8, a time for this, but you don't know. It's not like you know when each of those times are. There's a time for birth and death, to plant and uproot, to kill and heal, and it just goes on and on and on. And we don't have any control over any of that. And so he keeps coming back to this idea that if you take God out of the picture, there's really no guarantee, no sustenance that you can count on, and life just kind of ends up being empty. What we hope to do, just to flash forward a little bit to the Christian dispensation, is we want to find souls who get that. And we want to reintroduce the concept of God. And we want them to see the substance that Jesus can provide. So what is his recommendation for life under the sun? He gives it about seven times in this letter. He says, all right, it's not really going to amount to anything you can super duper count on anyway. And it'll never really fill you up. You know, he talks about that. You can try riches, but you won't be able to sleep. Or the more you make, the more they take, or whatever. So here is my recommendation to you under the sun. Under the sun, before we get to God, what is it? Just life here. You guys see that in the material? The recommended philosophy for life is what? Look in chapter 3, verse 12. This comes up about 7 times in these 12 chapters. The recommendation is this: I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is a gift of God. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it, nothing to take away from it, for God so worked that men should fear him. Now, the fear him portion is certainly there in the spiritual aspect. But in verse 12 and on throughout this material, the recommendation, look in chapter 3, verse 22. The recommendation is, I have seen that nothing is better than a man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? So what's the recommendation in life on earth? Just enjoy what you have. But I don't stop. You live on earth, you don't live in heaven. You live in the flesh, you don't live in some eternal perfect body. Here it is not always fair, the race is not always to the swift, he says in one place. So you take what you have and where you are in this life and in that body, and you be happy with it. Rejoice in those activities, because you don't know, verse 22, what may occur after you. In other words, even what you've got may be gone tomorrow. So you need to enjoy it now and today. So what it ends up being is this really sort of sobering, like I said, somber lesson, but has this great point that weaves its way all the way through, and that is, make the most out of what you have, because that's what you have. This is what you have. Do well with it. Now, the great sort of undertow that keeps pulling you back, though, is the idea of God. Fear God. And so when we get to chapter 12, Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verses 13 and 14, life is not just about under the sun. That's how we're living today. We're just here on earth trying to get through this thing. But there is a greater spiritual implication above it all. And so in the end, chapter 12, verse 13, the conclusion when all has been heard is, fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. And you go back through the book of Ecclesiastes and you start to see that it actually tells you to fear God about every chapter. Doesn't look like it's about God at all, but he keeps kind of putting that in there, because that's what gives life more than just under the sun substance. Okay, if it's been a while since you've read Ecclesiastes, take a look at those 3 or 4 bullet points there about what's going on in the book, and then sit down and give that thing a read. I told somebody the other day, it's the book of James of the Old Testament, really practical, or maybe James is the Ecclesiastes of the New Testament, but it's just every verse is sort of like, okay, yeah, I can live that, and it has that sense to it. Okay, any comments or questions about Ecclesiastes? What does that word mean, by the way? Okay, one who addresses the assembly, or the preacher, that's right. Something that really helps us in Bible survey is if you're reading in a book and it has a title, you probably should know what that title means, what it's about. It really helps you a lot. That's the case with Ecclesiastes. Okay, how about the Song of Solomon? There's another one that he wrote. We don't quote that one or read that one from the pulpit a lot. There's some really interesting language therein. I noticed a huge Facebook trend this week is Valentine's cards from the book of Song of Solomon. And, you know, your neck is like the warrior shields of Gibeon. And I don't know, it's some interesting imagery of beauty there, that not the kind of terminology we would use. But what's interesting about Song of Solomon is sort of the debate that goes on about how many characters are in the book. What we know is it's a love story. Solomon wrote about the love that he had for this Shulamite maiden. Now, I'm in the camp that says that there are 3 characters in Song of Solomon and not just 2. It could be Solomon's writing about this Shulamite woman and his love for her, and he's noting her love for him, and they just sort of end up together in the end, except he has 1,000 women. You know, he has a harem of women, and I see something else here. I see that she is in love with somebody else. Are we on the same page, you and me? Let's just move on. The shepherd boy. Look in chapter 6, Solomon, Song of Solomon, chapter 6. There just seems to be this man who's not the ruler of the nation with 1,000 women. There's just this boy who works out with the flock and in the field, and she can't get her mind off of this guy. Chapter 6 and verses 1 and following. Where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned that we may seek him for you? It's the chorus of the ladies that she's with. My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of balsam, to pasture his flock in the gardens and gather lilies. I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine, he who pastures his flock among the lilies. And it may be that she's saying he's out there in the field, he's gone, but I long for him. Look, this is not the kind of thing that's going to split a church, all right? But it is a really interesting study because it may be about Solomon and her. But I see there that Solomon has drawn her in as one of his, intending for her to become one of his wives. But she loves this boy. And ultimately, she has to choose between love or money, security or passion. And the ending of that is, well, if you haven't read it, you should read it. Chapter 8, verses 1 through 7. She makes the right choice. If we're wrong about this and it's about her and Solomon, then she loves him and she loves him for who he is instead of his money. It kind of makes a similar point. Song of Solomon. Okay. Let's go ahead and turn and be prepared to look at page 26. This is where we ought to have began this morning. We're in lesson 7, pages 26 and 27. We have looked at Saul and David and Solomon. It's about 931 BC, around that 1,000 number, and we're about to have a division in the kingdom. Before we do that, let me ask our drill questions. Question 1. List at least one prominent figure from the following time period. 3 round numbers we'll use. Give me the prominent figure from 2000 BC.
Abraham.
2000 Abraham. 1500 BC. Moses. Good. And 1000 BC. David. All right. Obviously, lots of other characters there, and you can link them together. You've got people like Joseph who are in between. But if you know those three, it's a lot easier to fill in the gaps between those three gentlemen. All right, what are the books of 1 and 2 Samuel about?
Last Judge.
First King.
And the Second King.
Okay. Last Judge, 1 Samuel 1 through 8 or 9. First King, Saul gets 1 Samuel 10 through the end of 1 Samuel, 31 chapters, I think. And then 2 Samuel is about David, the rule of David. 1 Samuel 16 through 31 is about David and Saul and their interactions, but David's not king. So all that Goliath stuff and hiding in the cave and the relationship with Saul, all that's going to be in late 1 Samuel. 2 Samuel is entirely devoted to the rulership of David. What are the books of 1 and 2 Kings about?
All right.
It is important to note that 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings fit together just like this. You could call them, and while we don't call them this, it's always helped me, 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 Kings. It's really just one set. You have, as you just mentioned, 1 Samuel, you have the ending of the Judges, the first king Saul. 2 Samuel, you have the second king David. 1 Kings 1 through 11, you have Solomon, the third king. And then 1 Kings 12 through 2 Kings, you have the divided kingdom, which we're going to talk about today. So that all works as a unit. Can somebody tell me why the last 8 chapters of 2 Kings is only the southern kingdom? No northern kingdom mentioned at all. They don't exist anymore. Remember that the southern kingdom, and we'll see all this beginning in today's lesson, lasted 100 plus years longer than the northern kingdom. So naturally, at about 2 Kings 17, when you get to 722 BC, and we're going to get to study this tonight, Sennacherib. Does that just sound evil? Sennacherib. We'll be studying him tonight. He's this evil Assyrian ruler. 722 finishes off the northern kingdom. Well, that's 2 Kings 17. You still have about 8 or 9 chapters left. Well, that keeps you going because the southern kingdom keeps going. They make it till about 600 before they run into big trouble. Okay, so when we get to 1 and 2 Chronicles, which is also a question on your sheet there, question 4, it's time to reset. 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, there's your story. 1 and 2 Chronicles, let's reset and do it again. So how would you break down the books of 1 and 2 Chronicles? What are those really boring things that... Yeah, I see. Instantly, the word came out. It begins with genealogies. I always say genealogies because it helps me spell it. Do you know there's an A in genealogies? What's that about? Genealogies. Starts out with about 9 chapters. So here's the Chronicles, and this is clearly a prophet in Judah. This is later. Nobody really cares about Saul anymore. Nobody really even cares about the northern kingdom. This is a chronicling of the southern kingdom. So the first thing he does is he just genealogies it for 9 chapters, 10 chapters. He wants you to know all the characters going back to Abraham and Moses and David and Saul, and he fills it all in. When it comes time to tell you the story of Saul, how much time does the chronicle writer take? Yeah, really like 6 verses. He lived, he was bad, he died. End of story. Now, there's a lot more you could say about Saul, but the chronicle writer has an entirely different purpose. He just wants you to see Judah's history. So 1 Chronicles, that's chapters 1 through 10. Genealogies, Saul. What is the rest of 1 Chronicles about? Whom? David, right? That's where he wanted to get all along. The chronicle writer wants to tell you about David. That's their real patriarch of who they are, of the southern kingdom. So that's 1 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles then would be whom? Solomon and Judah. Good. Solomon for about 10 chapters, very similar to before. And then the rest of 2 Chronicles, it's going to mention the northern kingdom some because they're always kind of doing this, weaving. But it's really about the southern kingdom. A lot of, I think these books were written around the same time, all 6 of them. And so there's a lot of just direct quotes from one another. You'll be looking at a Kings chapter and a Chronicles chapter, and they will be literally verbatim word usage. So there's a lot of continuity between them. Okay, why did King Saul lose his right to have his heirs rule the people of Israel? He didn't obey all the law. What was his first major mistake? Saul's first one. Sometimes it's overlooked, but it ended up being the one that started this whole thing. First.
He didn't wait for Samuel.
Remember the offering? He was told to wait 7 days. He sort of feared the people. He thought he was losing his right to rule them, so he offered it. And of course, this is the way God works. About as soon as he's lit that thing on fire, what happened? Samuel comes walking around the corner. So you ready to do this? I mean, that's the way that works. You have to be patient. So that was 1 Samuel 13. And then, of course, what did he do in 1 Samuel 15 that just reiterated the fact that he wasn't the right choice for a dynasty? Yeah, with King Agag, he left the king alive. He brought home some of the spoil, and a really powerful story there. And then he went on to really prove the point by trying to kill everyone who loved him out of jealousy and rage to try to preserve his rule. What notable messianic promise did God make to David, and where is that promise found in the Bible?
Say that again over here.
Your throne shall be established forever. 2 Samuel 7, 12 through 16.
Thank you. 2 Samuel 7, 12 through 16. This morning's lesson is built out of a friend of mine's recent examination of 2 Samuel 7. Is it as clear as we say that it is? Is it even really about Jesus at all? We'll get to talk about that in just a few minutes, I hope. But ultimately, as you'll see in the sermon this morning, the answer is a resounding, pretty amazing yes. That's announcing the coming. Isaiah sort of reiterates it and all these kinds of things. Which Old Testament letters were written, we said this already, which were written by Solomon? I think I heard it all in there. Did you guys hear it all in there? Proverbs. All right, 2 bonus questions. Who wrote the last 2 chapters of Proverbs since it was not Solomon? King Lemuel. And Agur, because I that sermon the other day, Agur's final 2 requests. Isn't that awesome when Agur said, you know, keep me away from you. Don't give me evil companions and don't give me riches or poverty. It's pretty rich stuff. Song of Solomon, and he wrote at least 2 psalms, as we noted in the material. All right, that gets us up to speed on what we want to do for the rest of this morning. But is there anything on your mind? Any follow-up questions? Lack of clarity? You've been eyeing number 250 for the last 20 minutes, and you want it?
Right there.
All right, let's take a look at our material today. Look at the top of page 26. It's time to discuss the divided kingdom. The year is about 931 BC, which fits nicely in our examination of David and all that stuff around 1,000. Let's open our Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 11. One of the really cool things that will start happening the more you study stuff like this is when somebody in a Bible class says, open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 11, your little mental Rolodex will start just flipping just like that, and you'll say, this is the beginning of the divided kingdom. Because I know that 1 Kings 1 through 10 is Solomon's reign, So I know exactly where we are. When you start making, the first time you make one of those little electrical connections, you really start to see kind of where we're going with laying these things out. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 9. 1 Kings 11, 9. Now the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods. But he did not observe what the Lord had commanded. So the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear it away, all of it, or all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. Of course, that is Judah. God preserved Judah. He preserved the kingship of Judah because he'd already promised that Jesus would come through that line. So you have Solomon's son, who became a party to the division of the kingdom. What is the name of Solomon's son?
Rehoboam.
Rehoboam is Solomon's son, and you probably remember some of the story there that Rehoboam was asked by the people to treat them in a certain way, and he consulted, he was advised by older men who said, you really need to ease up on the people. But he listened to the advice of his young friends, and they said, you need to be like a scorpion, you need to be tougher. And what it ultimately did is it caused this other fella named Jeroboam. That's kind of easy for us to remember, Rehoboam, Jeroboam. I kind of think of it as opposites. Jeroboam went up to Israel, but the J, Judah, Rehoboam was in the south. So Jeroboam up here, Rehoboam down here. And they split, and Rehoboam wants to bring it all back together, and God tells him, no, this is what has to happen. So you end up with the southern tribe of Judah and the northern tribe of Israel. You've probably heard that terminology. This is where that terminology begins. Jeroboam leads 10 tribes north. This becomes Israel. This is noted for us right here in 1 Kings 11, about verse 31. He said to Jeroboam, take for yourself 10 pieces. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and give you 10 tribes. So ultimately, the message here is this was God's plan because of Solomon's sin. You can't fix this. So Jeroboam will take 10 and they will move north. Now, when you start trying to figure out who the 10 is, and you think, okay, if there are 12 tribes, 10 goes north and 2 stay south, who are those? It can be a little bit confusing. So I tried to lay it out here for you. The tribes that were from, these tribes were from 8 of the sons of Jacob, and remember 2 of Joseph's sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. So you have 8 of Jacob's sons, Dan and Issachar and Gad and Reuben and all these, and you have Manasseh and Ephraim. So the ones that stayed in the south were actually 3, Judah, Benjamin, and your Levites, because the Levites continued to officiate at the temple just as they were supposed to officiate at the temple. So you end up with Judah was huge. Benjamin was kind of a bit of an appendage to Judah. So they were south of them, so they just kind of hung out with them. And then the Levites. All right. Rehoboam kept 2 tribes, as we mentioned there. And in 1 Kings chapter 12, you see that in verse 21. 1 Kings 12 and 21, when Rehoboam had come to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin, 180,000 chosen men. They were ready to go fight, and God said, don't go. This is what has to happen, and they departed. All right, let's go back and take a look at that chart of Kings. Turn back, if you have material, to page 23. If you don't have material today, try to see if you can look off somebody next to you. This is where we start to see more relevance with these 2 charts that you have on page 23. It is the chart of the Jewish kings. They have divided in 931. You might remember, whether you have the material in front of you or not, how many kings ultimately were there in the north, starting with Jeroboam? 20. 20 in the north. How many good ones? That's right. See, you were writing before you said anything. The answer is silence. There are no good ones in the north. It really started with Jeroboam. We don't have time to get into this study. But Jeroboam famously or infamously said when it was time to worship. You guys remember what Jeroboam said infamously when it was time to go do what God said in Jerusalem? That was his fear. So his proclamation was, it is too far for you to go back to Jerusalem. His fear was, they'll go back and they will desert me. So he started building other places to worship. High places. That's a term you read a lot in the Old Testament. High places. It wasn't always idolatry, but eventually, I mean, you're at the wrong place. It's not very long before you start doing the wrong thing, and it just sort of multiplied on itself. But that's probably a large driving force as to why you have no good kings. What's another reason why the Northern Kingdom never got a good run of good kings going?
They just kept killing each other.
You know, there was no God-supported family. In the South, God said, this is my choice. But in the North, it was every man for himself. And so if you're looking at that chart, you have Nadab was slain, and Eli was slain, and Zimri was in it for a week and killed himself. Ahab and Ahaziah. And look at the bottom section. Kings numbers 15, 16, 18, 19, 20, all murdered. Just a really desperate and terrible, terrible time for the North. Bonus question, haven't gotten there yet, but it's a good time to get this perspective. Who were the prophets that you know by name who spent their entire lives preaching the word to the Northern Kingdom? Elijah and Elisha. You want a little extra perspective on what they went through and how hard that was and the kind of faith that it took to do the work that they did? Read about Elijah and then Elisha in the context of that left column. Just terrible sin everywhere, and nobody ever turned it around. It's not like Elisha could say, well, at least this happened. The nation never did right, not once. Now, on the other side, we start with Rehoboam, and we understand why. That is Solomon's son. Every king on that right side is of the same tribe, the tribe of Judah. That's part of God's wisdom in sending, does this make sense now? Sending 10 tribes north. Get them out of here. Just keep Judah, and Benjamin was kind of like this assistant appendage, but just keep Judah, which would promote kingships continually coming from Judah, and is what happened. The real sort of dark spot in all of that is Queen Athaliah, number 7, who murdered her, grandchildren? And so that she could become queen. And there's some dark stuff there as well. Let's be clear. There's a lot of murder there as well, but a lot less of it. How many good kings in the South? A few, right? What are some names that jump out at you as good kings of the South? Josiah. Love Josiah. Hezekiah. Jehoshaphat. I think, as I preached some time ago, Asa was 95% good. Mostly good. There are some surprises in there. Don't think that you know this list. When you read, when you're doing your Bible read this year and you're reading through the kings, have this thing kind of sitting over here and reference it. You might be surprised. You know Manasseh. People will tell you Manasseh is as bad as it gets. You know there's a great chance Manasseh's in heaven. Do you realize that? Asa was 95% good and fell off at the end. Manasseh was 95% evil and ended his life turning to God. So there's some great, incredible stories there. But this is just a quick chart to give you some reference to that. All right, let's head back over to our material. Any questions about the way this is breaking up? Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the Northern Kingdom. It will get less of our attention for obvious reasons. It did not last as long, the Northern Kingdom. It did not produce the Messiah. It was not the lineage of David. But there are a few things we can say about it. The Northern Kingdom lasted about 210 years, 931 to 722. It is discussed for us primarily 1 Kings 12 through 2 Kings 17. The kingdom lasted 209 years before taken captive by the Assyrians. You can note, as we already did, that all the kings were poor. Let's have everybody please open their Bibles to 2 Kings 17. Now, you can see it on the page, but I want to ask you out loud to help with the mental Rolodex stuff. If I'm studying the Northern Kingdom, and I ask you in a sermon to open your Bibles to 2 Kings 17, what's happening? It is the divided kingdom, but we're in 2 Kings 17. Where are we in the Northern Kingdom story? Yeah. The end. This is the end. If I said, let's talk about Israel, open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 12. It's Jeroboam, that's the beginning. But I've asked you to go to 2 Kings 17, it's the end. This is their final days. Well, if you want to sort of work on some bonus material, it's about 722 BC, because I know that's when they're done, 722. Okay, 2 Kings 17. clearly documents exactly what happened to them. This is certainly a preachable text. Three things that caused their downfall. First one, their irreverence toward God. Look in 2 Kings 17, verse 7. Everybody should be there. We're going to do a little bit of reading in 2 Kings. Now this came about because the sons of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up from the land of Egypt, from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and they had feared other gods. Verse 13, the Lord warned Israel and Judah through all his prophets and every seer, saying, turn away from your evil ways. Verse 14, they did not listen, but stiffened their neck like their fathers, who did not believe in the Lord their God. Verse 25, at the beginning of their living there, they did not fear the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. Verse 34, to this day they do according to their earlier customs. They do not fear the Lord, verse 34. Nor do they follow their statutes or the ordinances or the law or the commandments which the Lord commanded the sons of Jacob, whom he named Israel, with whom the Lord had made a commandment. So I've given you that list on your sheet. That's a snippet in the text of one of their major problems. They lost their reverence for God, which has a lot of powerful little subpoints. Like, how do you lose reverence from God? You stop reading and obeying His law. You start replacing Him with other things. That's how you become irreverent. But that wasn't their only problem. Secondly, and really connected to that, was their influence of the world. They were heavily swayed by what was going on around them. You may remember way back when Joshua entered the land, God said, when you go into this land, there's something really, really important that you need to do. And if you don't do this, it will destroy you. What were they told to do when they entered the land? Take everybody else out. No false god worship, no pagan evil influence. But the northern kingdom in particular did not do that. Largely because when they moved up north to take that space, they didn't really have God's blessing to win all those wars. So one of the things that got them was influence. So go back and look through the same section I just read, except a couple of different verses. Verse 8. It said, verse 7, they feared other gods, but why? Because they walked in the customs of the nations whom the Lord had driven out before the sons of Israel, and in the customs of the kings of Israel, which they had introduced. Verse 11, there they burned incense on all the high places as the nations did, which the Lord had carried away to exile. Verse 15, they rejected His statutes. Look at the end of verse 15. They went after the nations. It's an interesting word to mark in this text, nations. They went after the nations, verse 15, which surrounded them, concerning which the Lord had commanded them not to be like them. Verse 19, Judah did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the customs which Israel had introduced. That's an interesting verse. Because what that means is the northern kingdom travels north. They keep all these worldly people around them. So they start being worldly. So guess what happens to God's precious southern kingdom of Judah as they interact with their own brother? They start adapting it as well. When Judah was being like Israel, they were being like the world because Israel was being like, it's like secondhand smoke. It's about when I let the world influence me, I act like that's the end of it. Okay, I let the world influence me. That doesn't affect anybody else. Look to your right. Because people younger than you, people who care about you, people who interact with you, they will become like the world through you. So what happens here, and I think you can see why God is just about fed up and done. They've been irreverent towards Him because they have been inundated with the influence of the world. And I've given you more verses there. That's just a few of them. And then, that all added up to their insistence on rejecting the truth. Look back at verse 13. Yet the Lord warned Israel and Judah throughout all His prophets and every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways and keep My commandments, My statutes, according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent to you through My servants the prophets. However, they did not listen. It wasn't that God was asking them to do something new and amazing and different. Just keep the law that I gave you. Ooh, bonus trivia question. How many years earlier? Keep the law I gave you blank years earlier. What goes in the blank? An evil question.
Sennacherib question.
The law was given through Moses. Moses lived in 1500. No, this is the end. 2 Kings 17. This is 700. Got about 800 years. He said, look, that's right. He said, I'm not asking you to do anything new or novel or unique or different. I just want you to go back to what I gave you hundreds of years earlier and just do that. I find that to be important. If I'm teaching this lesson, if I'm preaching this sermon, telling you about Israel's mistakes doesn't really matter much. But when we bring it forward to what we're dealing with and how we live in a time of greater reverence towards God, and even our Christian friends are changing because they're becoming like the world and the culture and the nations around them, our nation becoming like other nations even, what do? We don't need any new ideas. That's all we have to do. God said, I took care of this. Well, in our case, I took care of this 2,000 years ago. Took care of it. All you have to do is go back. Restoration. Okay, so there are lots of verses there. If we went ahead and read verses 15, he said, you reject my statutes. And verse 16, you forsake the commandments and so forth and so on. It really boils down to these three ideas. The Samaritan nation, just to wrap up this concept of the northern kingdom. You've heard of the Samaritans, right? You don't read about the Samaritans in the Old Testament at all. And when you get through that 400 years of silence between Malachi, about 400 BC, and the Gospels, you wake back up in the text from 400 years of silence, and all of a sudden there are Samaritans all over the place. But they live north of Jerusalem. Okay? They live north. And Jesus travels from Galilee down to Jerusalem a handful of times, and every time you got to pass through Samaria. And you meet Samaritans, who are really interesting people. And of course, the woman at the well stands out in John 4. Who are the Samaritans? They didn't even exist before. Who are they? They're a mixed race. The Assyrians come in 722 BC. They just decimate the Israelite, the northern kingdom. But they leave some alive, and they leave a lot of their own people there. And they rename the place, and they create this mixed race called Samaritans because it was the region of Samaria. And that explains a lot about the correspondence between Jesus and the woman at the well and the really interesting relationship between the Samaritans and the Jews. You know, when things were going well for the Jews, the Samaritans would show up and say, remember, I'm your brother. But when things weren't going well for the Jews, the Samaritans would say, we're Samaritans, we're not Jews at all. It was really a fickle relationship. All right, that's all the time that we have for today. What we need to do, obviously, is pick up the Prego just a little bit moving forward. But we actually have an extra week in our class. So we have a little bit of space. But do this for me. Be really comfortable with the bottom of page 26 and all the prophets on page 27. Try to get comfortable with those oral prophets and literary prophets. And I think we can catch up quite nicely on Wednesday night.